Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 95, Exploding Kittens, Good vs. Evil. Today I'm joined by Carol Mertz, a multidisciplinary game designer, as well as the current senior game designer for Exploding Kittens. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
No, I'm so happy to have you. And also, I'm excited for you to not only explain how you got into gaming, but like, what is multidisciplinary game design?
So basically, it means I don't assign myself to any one particular medium when I'm designing games. When I am designing games, sort of like in my ideal space, it's concept before form. So like, if I have something that I want to express, or if I have an experience that I want to make sure that I'm designing, I basically build the medium around that experience. So for example, I've done a lot of video games. I've also made an interactive sofa that you play with your butt. And I've also done tabletop games. And it's like they all have their own way of interacting with the player and getting the players interacting with each other. And I don't want to limit myself to a particular medium. So it's across disciplines within game design.
So which discipline did you start with?
Video games. So I actually, my background is in web design and web development. So that was kind of an easy digital sort of transition into making video games. And from there, I started exploring what it's like to design card games, what it's like to work in alternative controller and like sort of hardware design and development as it relates to game design. And so like all of that has sort of informed my approach to designing games, and like right now designing games with Exploding Kittens.
So, okay, I know the story of the couch, but also I feel like you should talk about that just because the idea of playing a game with your butt on a couch is hilarious. And so please tell that story before we move on into what is the episode.
So it's probably my favorite game that I've ever made, honestly. It's called Hell Couch, a couch co-op game where the couch is the controller. So the idea was I was getting my master's in fine arts and game design at New York University at the time. And I looked at my friend Francesca, who was taking a class on what it means to like develop alternative controllers, which basically means ways to control games that are not classic controllers. And I looked at her and I was like, wouldn't it be funny if we made a couch co-op game where the couch was the controller? And that was sort of how Hell Couch was born. We put sensors into the sofa. We adorned it with LED lights. I recorded my voice and pitched it down so that I sounded like a demon. I hacked a fog machine and shoved it under the sofa. And we toured the country with it in 2019. And it's just, it's basically Simon Says, but with your ass. So the lights direct you to which seat cushion. It's, you know, three seat cushions, and you have to sit in the right one to release the demon from within. We called it exorcism exercise.
That's so funny. I keep thinking of like Sheldon Cooper in Big Bang Theory, where he has a specific spot, but instead it's like his reincarnated form is this hell couch.
Exactly.
I love that so, so much. And it actually, I mean, hey, it transfers into like this game that we're talking about. We're talking Exploding Kittens, which I feel like most people have played, but in this particular case, it's good versus evil. So like this hell couch, the evil side.
Yeah, it was foreshadowing.
Exactly. It was perfect. But so for the game, before we start talking about like the design itself, for anyone who hasn't played it, can you explain how to play the game?
Yeah, a lot of folks are familiar with Exploding Kittens. It's sold something like, I don't know, like 20 million copies at this point. Don't quote me on that, but it's sold many millions of copies. And the core concept of it is that it is the Russian roulette card game. There's a stack of cards. you know, the majority of which help you, and there's enough exploding kittens in the deck, exploding kitten cards in the deck, that if you draw them, that player is out, and it's enough kittens to knock out all but one player. At the end of the game, there is always one winner, exactly one winner. With good versus evil, the idea is to ratchet up the danger and intensity and sort of introduce even more player interaction. And so with good versus evil, it's the same core, like the core gameplay experience of lots of cards. There's, you know, enough exploding kittens to kill you, but there's also what we called Armageddon cards, where when you play the Armageddon, you start this sort of almost like a prisoner's dilemma mini game, where you've got now the God Cat card and the Devil Cat card. And I should say that this is specifically a tie-in to our new Netflix show, which is just called Exploding Kittens. And it's a cartoon that it's just launched on Netflix in July. And so God Cat and Devil Cat are the two main characters in the show, right? And, you know, clearly God Cat is theoretically the good one and Devil Cat is theoretically the bad one. So you pick one to put in front of yourself and you pick one to put in front of any other player. And these are both face down. That player has to decide if they want to keep them or swap them. And then you reveal, and whoever has Devil Cat explodes, and whoever has God Cat gets the most powerful card in the game. So it's a really high stakes moment that has never happened in the game before. And the idea of designing that particular mechanic came out of really wanting to like force players to look each other in the eye and really try to read each other on a deep level of like, how would you, you know, like, would you try to screw me over? Would you try to like double bluff me? what are you doing to me right now? And ultimately at the end, somebody feels really smart. Somebody feels like they pulled one over on the other player. And I really like that feeling and that experience of sort of making you interact with the person on the other side of the card, not just, you know, the stack of cards.
Oh, totally. Honestly, it reminds me of a Princess Bride where they have that scene where it's like, okay, poison is in one of these glasses. Which one are you going to drink? And then like someone took that idea and made like a game out of it for Budenschei called In Vino Morte, where you're literally just like, okay, here's either like wine or here is some poison. And it's always kind of fun to be like, oh, I poison myself because I know they're going to think I wouldn't poison myself. And it's like you get in this like, but then this. And then everyone's like trying to follow that logic. And you're just like, just pull the card. Just flip the card, please.
Yes, absolutely. And that was actually, funnily enough, that was the core inspiration behind the game Hand to Hand Wombat. It diverged wildly from that original core inspiration. But Hand to Hand Wombat is a physical social deduction game that was designed by Corey O'Brien for Exploding Kittens, and I was the lead developer on it. And so that was very much in my brain as I was approaching the good versus evil. Like, what are the different approaches we could take to this new version of the game that is meant to, you know, like kind of harness the power of heaven and hell, right? So yeah, that was very much a part of the thought process, was that gorgeous Princess Bride scene. It's like, how can we simplify this and make this work for, you know, mass market players?
No, I think that's a great inspiration. So for the God card, you said it's the most powerful. What does it do?
It can essentially clone any card in the deck. You can play it as anything that exists in the deck that you're playing. And so there's, you know, there's diffuse cards, there's attack cards. So a diffuse card would basically cancel out an exploding kitten and save you from dying. An attack card would force the next player to take two turns. So like your turn plus their own turn. And if you know that there's a, you know, a kitten on the top of the deck, obviously that's a good way of screwing somebody over. There's also, you know, a lot of new cards like Reveal the Future, where you show, you know, the other players what's on the top of the deck. So everybody has an idea of what's coming. And my favorite is a card that I designed called Raising Heck, where you take the card from the bottom of the deck, you look at it, and you decide whether you want to keep it or put it on top. And you can imagine, like, the reason why you would want to put it on top is probably because it's bad, because you usually want to keep good cards and most of the cards are good. But also you could totally do that to screw with somebody's head. And I love that moment where suddenly you put the card on the top and everybody's like trying to avoid it. And then it comes back around to you and you're like, okay, I'll take it.
No, I thought it was cool that in this one, when you defuse, you get to, I don't think it was a part of the original Exploding Kittens, but I'm pretty sure you randomly put back in the Exploding Cat when you defused it. But this one you get to choose, right?
So it's always been, you get to choose where you put it. Some people sort of house rules that you just jam it back into the deck wherever. but it's always essentially you can either count cards, like you can't look at any other part of the deck, but you can always count cards and put the diffuse anywhere you want.
Gotcha. I think my friends were just always mean to me, and I just like, I don't know, I like made it seem in my brain that they weren't being mean. I was like, oh yeah, no, we're friends. This was random. Apparently it wasn't. Oops.
That's all right.
So what made this project kick off? Like, why did they decide? Was it because of the Netflix show that they needed this good versus evil? Or did the Netflix show come because of this game? Like, what was the timeline here?
Yeah, the game was definitely inspired by the show. But, you know, at Exploding Kittens, like, I almost compare it, like, having a huge franchise like this to almost having, like, a live service video game where you want to continue supporting your players, right? You want to continue releasing content so your players still have something to do and something new to engage with the game. So there's definitely, you know, an element of trying to keep up with a cadence of releasing new stuff for our players to get excited about. And so, you know, there's part of that where I was already ideating new game ideas. Like, we had just released Zombie Kittens, which was the game where you can come back from the dead, that was led by my coworker Ken Gruhl, who I think you've also interviewed in the past.
Confirmed, yes.
Yeah. Happy Salmon Guy.
Or Mantis, yeah. For those of you who listen to
Mantis.
The episode.
Yeah, exactly. Which is also an Exploding Kittens game. So, you know, we had just done Zombie Kittens, and we were sort of like, you know, the entire dev team, there's, you know, three designers on the dev team at the time, and we were all sort of poking around with ideas and sort of thinking about what could be next. And I, like I said, I had just wrapped up on Hand to Hand Wombat and very much had that sort of Prisoner's Dilemma / Princess Bride idea in my head. And I was like, what if we apply this to Exploding Kittens? What if we apply this as sort of like a little mini game? How does it work? And it turned out, you know, everybody on the team really enjoyed it. And so that was sort of the basis by which we started designing it. And then we realized that the show was going to be coming out around the time that we were planning on, you know, launching that next iteration of the game. And so we're like, all right, let's absolutely like make this a symbiotic situation and, you know, work toward having this be a tie-in with the show. Because, like, I mean, the show has been in development for years. Like, it has been something that has been on the team's radar for a while. And so, like, getting an idea of when the launch window would be for both the show and the game was just, like, it made it an obvious sort of outcome.
Oh, totally. I mean, the artwork is also very cute. I haven't watched the show, but I've seen the commercials for it. But the cards very much match that feeling of it. And it also, I mean, in the gameplay, you can have it where if you do use the God card, it goes back and there's multiple Armageddons, correct?
Yes. Yeah, there's three Armageddons in the deck. And so as soon as the God card is played, Armageddons are fair game again, which is pretty cool. The other thing to note is, like, once we did decide to tie it into the show, I started having a lot of conversations with Matt Inman, who's the Oatmeal, who was the showrunner essentially, and, you know, talking about how does this tie into the show? What can we do to lean in more to the, you know, the dynamics of the show and the aesthetics of the show and things like that? And that was, you know, the card Raising Heck that I mentioned earlier. I decided to name it that after I heard Matt talking about the idea of heck being sort of like teenager hell, so like a little closer to purgatory.
God,
yeah, exactly. So it's like, it's not as serious as hell, but it's not as, like, you know, like passive as purgatory, I guess. So it's just heck where the teenagers go. And I was like, I love that we're pulling that into the game. And so, yeah, we did a lot of back and forth discussions and a lot of feedback sessions just to make sure that it, like, once we knew that was, you know, the sort of the ultimate goal of what this game was going to be, that it really did line up with the vision of the show.
For the artwork, did you ever end up including, like, some of the characters from the show besides the two cats?
100%. So, like, all of the artwork is completely taken from the characters in the show. I mean, so there are some, like, new introductions of, like, there's new cat cards that I don't want to spoil, but, like, the cat cards are when you play them as a pair, you get to steal a card from somebody else. And, like, all of the cat cards, I think, are new. But, like, the, you know, the attack cards, the skip cards, everything, like, they're all pulling characters from the show. And it's really fun to see those nods. And to have gotten, you know, from my perspective, I got a taste. I got a look at the early concept art and things like that, which was really fun. Like, I didn't do the art, to be clear. I just did, you know, game design and game development. But I got to witness a lot of that art development process. And it was really cool.
That is so cool. Did you find it hard to work with exploding kittens as far as like this game is well known. We want to stick to most of the same gameplay, but like we want to do something different. Like how much wiggle room did you have in that design?
So it's interesting because one of my first projects as a full-time like staff designer at Exploding Kittens was a game called Exploding Kittens Recipes for Disaster, which is a game that we sort of assembled to in order to put basically all the best cards from every expansion that had released so far into the same box. And what we did to sort of like provide value for the players was to create custom deck designs that each deck basically created a unique experience for the player. So some felt very intense, some felt very fast, some felt like you could, you know, like feel a little bit psychic that you were looking into the future all the time, stuff like that. So we had this like approach with that game where we build a deck with a core experiential thesis around it, right? And so that really, I think I got really lucky in that that was my first project, the first major project at Exploding Kittens, because it really taught me like the core of what it means to be a developer for Exploding Kittens. Because ultimately it did mean there is a lot of creative freedom within the constraints of the existing deck. And so I really took that and ran with it for this. And I, you know, using a few of the new cards that I designed and also a pile of cards from all of the other games and expansions, I created a deck that felt, you know, like it sort of lended to the experience of this being a very high intensity, high player interaction deck. And I think that, you know, for me, I felt like there was a lot of opportunity to creatively explore and really push what that meant.
No, that is so cool that you got to have that freedom and the ability to like play around with so many of the decks and have that knowledge of prior versions of the game so you could take from it.
Yeah, I think it made a big difference. And the one thing I do want to mention, like, since this is a game design podcast, I do love Recipes for Disaster as a product that does help introduce people to what game development really is, because the entire point of the game also is to allow players to build their own decks and to explore what that looks like and to, you know, play around with the cards in the box and write out their list of what their ideal deck would be. And so it really gives players a chance to like think a little bit more critically about that and then actually document what they're working on and what they're creating. So, you know, I don't know that it ever really fully got marketed in that perspective, but to me as a designer, as a developer, I see it as a really interesting tool to introduce people to that, you know, to that process.
As far as like design versus development, what do you think are the key differences between the two, especially while working at Exploding Kittens?
Totally. So design is very much like R&D almost. Like, so you're coming up, you're like looking into researching the ideas of, you know, what is gonna hit with our audience, what is going to resonate with, you know, the leadership at the company, what are some areas that I think are fruitful to explore, and coming up with those original concepts, making those first prototypes, sort of just making those proof of concepts for like the original game designs, right? So that's the design process. And then development is taking that design and turning it into something that can actually reach shelves. So testing it a ton, writing and testing all the rules, really going through that iterative process, working closely with the art team to make sure the user experience on all of the componentry is working for the players, making sure everything feels balanced. That's the entire, like, that's the development process. So I think, you know, they're both really core, very important. But, you know, at Exploding Kittens, everybody who has a game designer title is ultimately both a designer and a developer because we're taking the games from start to finish. So it's easy to conflate the two. But a lot of times, obviously, as you know, in board game design, they're kind of separate titles. If you're hired as a designer, you're hired as an inventor, you know, you're hired because you have this concept that you're bringing to the table. If you're hired as a developer, you're hired to refine that concept and make sure that it's ready to go to production.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's such an interesting thing where it bleeds into each other so much, where there's times like I've worked as a developer where I'm like, I've basically gutted this design and really, I mean, the outside's there, but everything else is totally different. And it's like, well, it feels now it's a co-design, but it's like still development. So it's like always that weird, when does it bleed into what? When do you change those titles? How do you have those conversations? Like I did an episode with Julie Ahern where she was a developer that became the designer. And that's like, she talked about how that conversation could have gone really bad, because especially when you're working with like egos, it's different versus if you're on a team working for a company. I feel like the ego is removed more.
Yeah, by necessity, right? Like, because you're all working toward a common goal, as opposed to like typically, you know, if it's a more independent project, it's like somebody has a very specific vision and it's usually expressive, you know, and like ego is an interesting thing because a lot of times people view it as negative. But like, you know, if you have something that you want to say, it's important that you feel like you can say it in the design that you're making. But a lot of times for mass market, it's less about the designer as like a form of artistry and more about the player as a form of like audience, right? So it's just kind of different perspectives, I think.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. More on the hobby side, because I've had to do development with designers where we signed their product and it's like, I have to develop it to fit our publisher that I worked for. And then it's like, oh, well, here's this ego because the designer had a vision. And it's like, well, they chose to sign it with us, maybe because they just needed the game out, maybe because they thought their vision aligned with us. But then when you have those hard conversations of like, well, this game doesn't actually fit our audience, but we have to tweak it this way, and then it's there. Sometimes you get that conflicting, like, headbutting.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I mean, I think that's going to happen a lot with creatives. It's definitely a challenge to the process. And it's, you know, it's something to learn how to navigate for sure.
Very true. So how long in total do you think it was from that initial inspiration of taking what you had been thinking about at the Wombat game over into this and then like have it actually be out in people's hands for them to play for the good versus evil version of Exploding Kittens?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think Wombat launched, I want to say Wombat launched in the summer of 2021, and Good versus Evil launched in the summer of 2023, which means we would have wrapped development in, you know, late 2022. I was working on it basically, I would say the majority of 2022. It was largely, yeah, like from the start of the year where we were starting to like kind of fill out those like idea documents of like, here's the different directions we could go for the next iteration of what, you know, the Exploding Kittens franchise can go into. And then, you know, picking the one that we felt was a strong, sort of a strong option, and then seeing how that actually tied into the show launch window.
Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, that totally makes sense. And so how is the game doing now that it's out, but also the television show is out? Did you see like sales spike up? Did people buy it more? Or was it like, oh, this product was already out and it's just kind of like bundled together?
I think it's doing well. I haven't actually been keeping my eye on sales, if I'm being honest, but I know that, you know, they're doing a big marketing activation at San Diego Comic-Con, or by the time this airs, they will have done that. And I know that folks were getting really, really excited about it. So it's kind of seeing a second wind, you know, a year after launch, which is really cool for me as somebody who really cares about that, you know, that particular game, that particular version. So it's, yeah, I would like to think that it's having its little renaissance.
I love that. I'm so jealous of all my friends at the Comic-Con. I was like, oh, I want to go someday. It's like on my bucket list.
Same.
And so what was your favorite and then your least favorite experience of working on this design in particular with Exploding Kittens?
Oh, geez. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to say like what favorite and least favorite was because A, like I said, I did this 2 years ago. It's hard to remember, especially like what, like those big moments. I think like just the process was really nice to see it, how it evolved. Basically, again, coming up with the concept, saying, what if we take this little idea, this little mechanic, and really integrate it into the greater experience? Like, to me, that's everything. I would say, you know, least favorite experience was the fact that the show the show wound up releasing much later than we had anticipated. And so it was kind of a bummer that the game came out before people had a chance to really experience the show and be able to see how it tied in. I think it was a nice preview of what was upcoming, but I think it would have been a lot more exciting if at the time, you know, we were able to do both at the same time. But obviously circumstances were such that that just wasn't in the cards.
Terrible.
I know, I'm so sorry.
Please, no, it's so good. I love those terrible jokes. Oh my gosh. So then for any designer that's trying to work on a product that's like pre-existing, they're making a new version or an expansion or any of that, do you have any advice geared towards that kind of designer?
I mean, honestly, I've done that so many times at this point. Like I was the lead developer for Power Hungry Pets, which was a love letter game. I worked on That Escalated Quickly, which was based on Top 10 by Cocktail Games. So those were both partnerships with the original, publishers of those games. And ultimately, I mean, I think it's just a matter of approaching it with respect of the original game, right? And saying, I know that this is a great game, but how can I adjust it so that it fits the audience that I'm trying to reach? Because like Love Letter, obviously, major classic, but not necessarily reaching the same audience that Exploding Kittens is, right? So what, what changes, what updates, what modifications could I do as the developer on this particular assignment do to reach our mass market audience? And so, my approach to that particular one was try to encourage more player-to-player interaction, try to introduce more moments of humor and take that and things like that, where our players would feel like they were playing something a little bit closer to Exploding Kittens as opposed to like the original Love Letter. So those kinds of approaches, like, and again, I came into both of those games absolutely loving the gameplay of the original. Both of those approaches require like a deep respect and a deep appreciation for the original work, and not thinking that you're going to necessarily improve the original game, but adjust it for a different audience or adjust it for a different purpose.
What are the differences for Love Letter? I'm curious, like your guys's version.
Yeah, so again, because I love the original game, there's not a ton of changes, but the big things were I introduced a few new cards. And so there's one that's like a specifically like a slightly different strategy where if you hang on to the zero numbered card until the end of the round, it would actually beat out the highest value card. So that there was like a little extra layer of strategy. There's also some cards that are inspired by Exploding Kittens interactions. So cards that allow you to manipulate the deck a little bit, the way that you can in Exploding Kittens, things like that, that just kind of introduce a little bit more of that level of interaction. And then I also reduce the gameplay time. So reduce the number of rounds to win the game, essentially, just so that the game lasted closer to the sort of like expected gameplay length of more mass market games, as opposed to the longer sort of like arc of the original Love Letter.
No, this is good. So for anyone who doesn't know, like what is typically the time you're aiming for in mass market?
So at Exploding Kittens, our mantra is sort of 5 minutes to learn, 15 minutes to play. And that varies, from game to game, but the 5 minutes to learn is a pretty hard constraint for us because our players for the most part don't have a lot of background with games and don't have a lot of patience for reading super long rule books and don't know a lot of the pre-existing vocabulary. And to me, that's a really great constraint to have because it means that I am thinking about reaching as many people as possible and as many kinds of players as possible. So yeah, the expectation is that, they're not sitting down for an hour long or many hours long gameplay session. It's like low commitment, low barrier for entry. And our mentality is like, if they enjoy it, they can play it a second time. They can play it a third and fourth and fifth time. But if it's just a matter of it being an icebreaker or opportunity to interact in a party setting or in a family setting or whatever, we want to make sure that that's as easy as possible to introduce to other people.
No, I think that's great because a lot of my family members are very much not gamers. They're becoming it more because I am so into games. So now I'm getting them into like some of the heavier stuff. But like rule books are so intimidating. And I mean, honestly, I hate reading rule books. Like I've gotten to the point where if there's a video, I like watching it for context and then I'll read it.
Yes, 100% same.
Yeah. So it's like I think that's great. And the constraint of being able to teach something in 5 minutes is freaking awesome. Especially like I still pitch games to publishers. If I can get across the idea of my game in a minute or less, like that says a lot and it gets a lot more eyes on your game, especially nowadays, since it seems like hobbies starting to move into mass market. There's a lot more crossover.
100%, yeah. The distinction of what it means to pitch a game quickly versus teach a game quickly, and both of them, like having a succinct method of doing both is so key. Whether you're pitching to publishers or you're pitching to players or you're pitching to retailers, like those, both of those tools to have in your pocket is just like imperative to have a successful title, right?
Oh, for sure. Definitely a skill that can be taught and learned, but not always natural to every person. Well then, okay, so are there any other projects you want to touch on that fans should be looking out for that's either coming in the future or just recently came out that you worked on at Exploding Kittens or otherwise?
Yeah, my latest project that I led is a project called Why Are You Like This? Which is a really, really silly word guessing game that I think it's exclusive at Target right now. It is essentially like, it's a, like I liken it to a game like, you know, Poetry for Neanderthals, which is another one of our games, or Taboo or Pictionary, but it's all of those things at once. So on your turn, you draw a card and it tells you whether you can talk, draw, or gesture. Usually you can only do one of those three things, but sometimes it's a combination of them. And then it'll give you an added constraint on top of that. So like you can gesture, but you can only do it with someone else's arms. And it just gets like I said, it just gets the entire room laughing because it's designed to be silly. It's designed to make you do really weird and awkward things and like sort of let your guard down around everybody else in the room. And that's what I really love about it. And it comes with this nice little date night mode that's designed specifically for two players. And it comes with maybe slightly spicier words that get you guessing in, that get you in a very like specific mentality while you're guessing, you know what I mean?
Gotcha. So it's not a roommate date. This is like a, I'm on a date, wink, wink.
I mean, you can. So like it's the date night mode is really ultimately just co-op mode. So you can play it with as many people as you want to, but the cards are slightly more spicy, not like not explicit, but slightly more. So like, and you can also play, like, you can play co-op mode with the original cards. Like, they're just words, you know? But it comes with both of those modes so that you can kind of change the approach depending on the audience, right?
No, I think that's so cool. So, I mean, I personally, I love two-player games. I also like the games that are exclusively two-player. I go to a lot of board game cafes, and I always, like, I people watch for sure. And I'm always noticing, like, two-player games are typically the thing that's pulled out, or, like, things like Exploding Kittens that everyone kind of knows how to play. And it just feels so approachable. So I love when there is a party game that can go to two players because you can still have the fun of that, but with just like you and your best friend or you and your roommate or you and the person you're dating or married to or whatever it is. So I think that's really cool. Was that like an initial idea that you had or like an assignment like, hey, we need this to play two? Or did you play the game and you're like, let's make this a two-player mode too?
It's become sort of a necessity for Exploding Kittens games that like, basically every party game that we release at this point, we really want to make sure that it has a two-player mode. It's really important because like, especially over the pandemic, we realized there were a lot of people who were specifically seeking out games that could support two players. And so it really kind of defined our sort of constraints, like on a universal level. So we knew, you know, basically any project that we that we take on is going to need some sort of a two-player mode, unless there's a very, very strong reason to not have a two-player mode. So we definitely knew going into this that that was a part of the design needs and the design asks. But the date night mode specifically, I think, was a separate request, you know, for various reasons. They wanted to sort of be able to target, you know, the folks that were getting excited about games like We're Not Really Strangers and things like that, but make it less serious and less intimate in a, you know, like intimate in a like physical and fun way, but less intimate in a, I really don't need to be revealing all of my deepest, darkest secrets to you on our first date sort of way. You know what I mean?
What? You don't want a trauma dump on a first date?
Right. Like, I definitely think there's value in games like that, but I also have a really strong pull toward games that are specifically for dates. Like, that was what my MFA thesis literally was studying and producing for. So when I got that basically assignment from leadership at Exploding Kittens, I was like, oh, we got this. Like, this is in my wheelhouse for sure.
Like, I went to school for this. Let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
So wait, okay, in your opinion then, what makes a good two-player, like, date game? Like, pull from your knowledge.
So for me, I define date games, and like, one day maybe I'll do a video essay on this or something. My sort of constraints for date games are cooperative and encourages meaningful communication and collaboration. So I, love, like, Sky Team, I'm so happy they just won the Spiel, because, like, that to me is, like, it's not sexy. It's not, like, the kind of thing that you're gonna, like, you know, rip off your clothes afterward and get at it, right? But, like, it does help you learn how to communicate under constraints with somebody. It helps you see how somebody collaborates with you. And I think, to me, that's such a powerful way to get to know someone. So for me, like, I have a lot of, and I think you and I have talked about this in the past, like, I have a lot of experience with long distance relationships. And so the way that I've been able to get to know some of those partners in the past is playing, you know, online cooperative games with them and seeing how they communicate to me. Are they telling me what to do? Or are we collaborating and figuring out a solution together? You know, and it's not like it's a test, but it is certainly, like, a nice lens into how compatible are our communication styles, right?
I mean, definitely, because I know every time I'm dating someone, within the first 3 dates, there is going to be some form of game night, because I have to test it. Like, we play a cooperative game always, and then we play something that's competitive, because I want to see how they are communicating with me, but I also want to see, like, are they a sore loser? Or are they going to beat me? Like, how are they going to interact with me in that way? Because, like, I ideally would want someone who wants to play board games and wants to play test things. And so I think that's a great way to, like, test those communication skills, even if you're not a gamer, because you can be someone who doesn't play a ton of games, but, like, knowing how you're going to interact in a stressful situation, like, even if you're playing, like, I don't know, the Ops Rising games, it's like, oh no, we might lose to Thanos or whatever it is. It's kind of just, like, fun to be like, oh, well, how is this person thinking? Or is this person talking over me? Or are we, like, coming up with different ideas and then we're voting on it? Like, you learn so much from that. Also, it's just nice to not have direct eye contact over dinner, like, for 2 hours. Like, it's fun to have, like, we're looking at the board game, we're making jokes, and we're just having a good time.
You mean you don't love dates that feel like interviews?
Oh, I've been on those, and there was not a second.
Yeah. But, like, I love what you brought up about, like, the idea of, like, the other person doesn't have to be into games, but it's nice to see how they respond to something that they're, like, is sort of maybe out of their comfort zone, too. Like, that's one of my sort of driving forces. When I talk about games as, like, self-expression, I also think about games as a method of connection. And it is one of my core design pillars as an individual designer. And, you know, the game that I made for my thesis at NYU is a video game called With You. And it's free on Steam. It's like a 15-minute game that is specifically designed for people who are not necessarily comfortable playing video games. It's like very minimal inputs, very simple gameplay, but it is very cooperative, very collaborative by nature. And the entire point is to get two people talking, two people thinking about solving puzzles together, and allowing one person who might be really into games to introduce a partner who might not be into games to something that they might view as a hobby, and to something that, you know, like, might help encourage them to get excited about things that they might not have been otherwise.
Oh, that's really cool. I feel like I need to check that out.
Yeah, it's free, so, like, nothing's stopping you.
And is there anything else you'd want to touch on that we haven't already talked about?
As long as I got a platform, the only other thing that I really want to talk about is how important it is to think about, like, we've talked a lot about, like, games being approachable for people who don't play games very often, but I think it's really important to think critically about why people might not play games often, whether that's because of societal expectations around gender, physical or, you know, like, neurological ability that prevents people from being able to sit down and read the rules for whatever reason, or prevents people from being able to interact with a game that doesn't support colorblind players, or games that force, you know, visual communication, so somebody who's blind or, you know, or vision impaired can't interact with the game. So one of the things that I've been doing at Exploding Kittens is really trying to, you know, push for accessibility first mindsets, and, like, thinking about, like, what are going to be the accessibility challenges of any given game that we make, because ultimately, like, the more you think about that, the more people you open your game up to. And, you know, like, the nature of physical tabletop games is going to be that, like, every game is going to be unique. Every game is going to have its own set of constraints and its own, you know, like, experiential goals. And sometimes that's just going to mean that it's simply not accessible to people with certain disabilities, right? But what I've started to do with some projects at Exploding Kittens, and Hand to Hand Wombat is one of them, and Without Fail is another, which we didn't touch on, but y'all can look it up, is we worked with an accessibility consultant to test and analyze the games and talk about, like, where are the constraints on gameplay for people with certain disabilities, and how could we modify the game from a designer's perspective to take the pressure off the players so that they don't have to think about their own house rules, and like we can have like sort of a canon version for them, right? Like where it just basically says, hey, this is designed and tested by the original creators to accommodate certain disabilities. Here you go, enjoy. And you know, you can use that or not, but ultimately, like, it means that players who would normally have to modify the game for themselves, or players who normally wouldn't even feel like they could approach the game at all, suddenly have a tool set that they can use and reference that requires a lot less effort on them and gives them a confidence that, like, this is a thoughtful part of this game design.
No, I definitely been trying to push to do stuff like that. Like, even our party game, Caution Signs, at the very end, it shows, like, a bunch of ways you can change it for, like, younger ages or non-English speakers, or I guess whatever current language it's printed in. Just because it does, it shows that you thought about that group that typically is missed, and not everyone has the, like, mindset to be able to change the rules. Instead, they might just get frustrated and put the game down, or, like, get rid of it, or give it a bad review because they didn't understand the rule book. Like, I've seen plenty of those. So it's, like, nice to make that a little bit easier for each player. And it is hard because when you're trying to make something accessible, like, you just also need to realize that sometimes it's not going to be accessible to all parties. Or maybe you might make a design. So, like, last night we were playtesting a game that was inspired by the idea that, like, my grandma, she's basically blind. One of my best friends from elementary school is basically blind. And I wanted to make a party game that they could play, because it's like they hear about all these cool games and I tell them when they were released, but, like, they can't actually play any of them typically. And so I was like, okay, well, I want to make a game. And so I, like, talked to my co-designer, Scott, and was like, what do you think about this? And we came up with one, but as we were testing it, it's like, okay, this can be played by someone who's blind, but also someone who is, like, not dexterous with their hands, so, like, maybe they have arthritis or something, they're going to struggle a little bit. So it's like, oh, you just can never win.
But, like, that's exactly the kind of thing that I think is important to think about as a designer. Like, who am I excluding from this design? And are there ways that I could include them? Even if it's not in the core rule set, is there a way that I can make a suggestion or a modification to the core rule set that does accommodate somebody who might have fine motor challenges, or, you know, who might not be able to see the cards, or who might not be able to hear an auditory alarm go off? Like, how can I accommodate my deaf and hard of hearing players? Things like that, I think, is at least a good thought experiment to work through, if not something to actually and actively implement.
Yeah, no, I think that was a great thing, since you had a platform to bring up.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that I feel very passionately about since I've started, you know, working around it. And I just see so much opportunity for it. And, like, there's a lot more resources that are starting to come out. You know, there's not a ton of resources, but, like, there was just a book launched called Tabletop Game Accessibility that is, you know, goes through a lot of the challenges that people face and the way that some games have handled it well and others may not. And it's just, I think it's a really good tool to have in your toolbox.
I completely agree. Because honestly, even just, like, the age limits people put on the boxes, sometimes they scale it down. And I'm just like, you know that little kids can't hold that many cards in their hands. Like, I'll look and I'm like, you're saying that this kid is going to play where they have to hold 12 cards in their hand. I was like, they're not, though. Like, just because the game concept might sound simple and maybe you have a variant that's a family rule that allows little kids to play, don't put that on the box. Put it on for the main game. If you have a family mode that you've made those adaptions, that's great. Include it on the inside. Maybe you talk about it on the back of the box. Say, like, hey, we have a family mode, but do not make that the main age count, player count, whatever it is, because people will buy that game and then be disappointed, and then you're just going to end up with bad reviews, and it's just, like, a hot mess. Well, for my last question, I want to know, if you could have designed a game that you didn't design, which one would you have chosen? Stick to board game, tabletop, RPG, though. I know you do all the things, but, like, let's stick
I
with
do
that.
All the things. This is really hard. Like, there are so many games that I find, like, incredibly inspiring. So I think party game, I think Fake Artist Goes to New York is, like, just so good. It's such a classic for me. And, like, I think it's just incredibly well designed. And like, I love games that like leave behind artifacts that allow you to like kind of remember that gameplay experience. And so like, I love opening my box and like seeing like histories of past gameplay like in there. Like, oh my God, somebody drew such a weird looking sausage and I remember that time.
Okay.
I also really like from the TTRPG space, like Dread is just such a well-designed tension arc. So for those not familiar, Dread is a TTRPG where the decision mechanic is a Jenga tower. And as the game progresses, the Jenga tower gets more and more precarious. Like you pull a block to make a decision. And if you pull it successfully, you make that decision successfully. And if the tower falls, you die. So it's a horror TTRPG. And you can imagine how the tension increases dramatically throughout the game, where like it's a life or death pull. And I just think that that is one of the most clever and emotionally impactful TTRPG experiences that I've really bore witness to. And then finally, from the hobby space, there's an older game, not older, I mean, I think it's like 2016. It's a game called Consenticle. This is a two-player game. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's by Naomi Clark, who was one of my professors at NYU, but I'd heard about the game before I went. And it's a game about being a space explorer alien gal having sex with a tentacled alien creature. And it's like, it is a date game. It is a cooperative date game. And it is just such a interesting cooperative experience that is very much leans into an experiential, you know, like an experiential goal. And it is, I think, a really good gameplay lesson in consent. It's a good gameplay lesson in communication, both verbal and nonverbal. And it's also just like an area that I think is not very much explored in tabletop game, well, like I mean in games in general. And it's also just beautiful. Like it's a really nicely designed game. But I don't think it's in print anymore. It's a very like, that's a deep cut and it's a weird one. And
I was gonna say, it was like, I've actually heard of this game for all the reasons you'd notice or you'd mentioned, but I've not played it. So that, it does sound interesting. Do you still own it?
I do, yeah. I have one of the few copies. And actually just last night, the reason I was thinking about it is just last night, my best friend was like, would that be weird if we play it together? Can we play that soon? Because I really, I'm like, no, I've literally only ever played it with like, with friends. And it's a very funny experience to do that. But it's also like, again, like, I mean, fantasy is fantasy, right? Like you can set aside what the core idea of the game is in the context of the, you know, who you're playing with, and just experience the game. And I think that that's a really interesting way of approaching gameplay.
No, I think that's cool. I will say though, I played Fog of Love with a random person at like a con. Feel like it lost a lot of the experience.
I'm sure. <yeah.
laughs> I was like, random nerdy dude, first off, not my type or my vibe. But also, we were not vibing, our characters or us.
Oh. You learned so much about that person though, you know?
I did. And we've never spoken again.
Still I'm not fun. Surprised.
Oh my God. Well, I appreciate you so much for being on this episode and like for everyone who's been listening to it. This was Game Design episode 95, Exploding Kittens, Good versus Evil. But Carol, for you as a human, is there anywhere that people can reach you on like social media or something if they want to check out your designs?
Yeah. So I have a website, carolmertz.com, where I have like a lot of my game projects are available to take a look at there. Video game projects, there's a bunch of them up on carolmertz.itch.io. And then I'm also just on social media at carolmertz on all of the various social medias. So feel free to come find me and take a look at what I'm up to. And then, you know, from the Exploding Kittens end, they're on all the social medias at Game of Kittens, and you can buy all the games at explodingkittens.com.
Sweet. And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on social media or like Instagram, Twitter, whatever one you're using, it's always Token Gamer, and that's spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. Thanks for being on the show. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk about crunchy game design stuff.
Crunchy, exploding kittens, all of the above. Yes.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.